Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Also, posted links at kirksvilletoday.com and pieville.net. Today, we're going to finish Chapter 16, which is all about the Civil War in Russia and the Jews. And we heard last time about how Jews dominated all these various CK Extraordinary Commission. CK, I believe, is the part of two Russian words that means just that, Extraordinary Commission, CK, part of the OGPU, the GPU, the KGB, the NKVD, as it was variously called, the secret police, the political police, the people who come and arrest you during the night and take you to a sub-basement of the police station, interrogate you, or just plain shoot you. And the Jews flocked to join this, and it came in the Russian minds and the minds of the Russian people that the Red Terror equaled the CK, equaled Jews. And although Solzhenitsyn goes to some length to make, well, there were some Jews who didn't, you know, there's always some Jews who didn't do this or that. Not all the Jews support. Yeah, but the people making the equation was quite correct. And like an intellectual, he has to overcomplicate something. No Jews, no Russian Revolution. That should be called Jewish Bolshevik Revolution. Or just Jewish Revolution. Jews took power and started killing people. Remember, all the pogroms we went through earlier in the book, there was never more than like 30 to 40 Jews killed, honestly dead, from being attacked and beaten. And the rest was exaggerations and lies. But the minute Jews take power in Russia, why thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of white Russians, whites, that's what they're after, whites, start being murdered, starved, bludgeoned, shot, literally frozen, put on barges and have the barges sunk in the middle of icy rivers. Okay, that's what happens when Jews do it. You don't ever hear about Jew on white pogroms, do you? No, those aren't real Jews. They were renegade Jews. They were atheist Jews. They're not real Jews. And anyway, not all Jews did it. Not all Jews supported that. There's never any end of excuses. Solzhenitsyn basically would fit very comfortably into the conservative camp of excuse makers for Jews, as far as I'm concerned. So that's the irony of his book not even being translated, but still full of the typical conservative excuse making. Anyway, maybe I'm too hard on him. Maybe I'm not. I don't know. I don't really care. Anyway, we're going to pick up on page 512, and we'll run to the end of the chapter, which for our purposes will be about 524, since we're not doing the footnotes, because they're mostly in Russian. You can find the full PDF online, and I put it in the permanent thread on vnnforum.com. So let's begin with a new section after three asterisks on 512. Says Solzhenitsyn, let us now examine the white side. Okay, the white is the Russian loyalist, the Russian side. It's not a racial thing. It's just the name given to the political side that opposed the Bolsheviks, the whites, the white Russians, generals and people and such. Let us now examine the white side, he says at the top of page 512. At first glance, it may appear counterintuitive that Jews did not support the anti-Bolshevik movement. After all, the white forces were substantially more pro-democratic than Bolsheviks, as it was with white generals Denikin and Rangel, Denikin, D-E-N-I-K-I-N, and Rangel, W-R-A-N-G-E-L, and included not only monarchists and all kinds of nationalists, but also many liberal groups and all varieties of anti-Bolshevik socialists. So why didn't we see Jews who shared the same political views and sympathies there? Well, and the answer is obvious, because they're racially united, they're racially a team, and they know that Bolshevism is Judaism, and that's where they are. So the false belief that Jews fall into different political factions, which is beloved of the conservatives, pardon me, conservatives like to pretend that politics matters more than race, but you see, ultimately, always the Jews are on the same side. They all want what is good for Jews, and they will all run where the majority of them think that is. And that's why their race will always outlie their political views. Just look at any Jewish so-called right-winger. Well, so it is here, where there are various shades of leftist, but they all fall behind the Bolsheviks when they take actual power. Jews know that actual power is worth more than the political view they might be promoting. So why didn't we see Jews who shared the same political views and sympathies there? He doesn't answer the question. Fateful events irredeemably separated the Jews from the white movement. The Jewish Encyclopedia informs us that, quote, initially many Jews of Rostov supported the white movement. On December 13, 1917, a merchant prince, A. Alperin, gave 800,000 rubles collected by the Jews of Rostov to A. Kaledin, the leader of the Don Cossacks, to organize anti-Bolshevik Cossack troops. Yet when General Alexeyev, another white commander, was mustering his first squadron in December 1917 in the same city of Rostov and needed funds and asked, and note, and asked did not impress, the Rostov Nakhichevan bourgeoisie, mainly Jews and Armenians, when he asked them for money, General Alexeyev in the same city where Alperin had given money to a white, the Rostov Nakhichevan bourgeoisie, they refused, and he collected just a dab of money and was forced to march out in the winter with unequipped troops into his ice march. So the Jews are like the media when they swing through, hey, this is what we're doing. It goes through all the synagogues and the Jewish network, as we've heard about, and they all can flip on a dime if need be. And later, quote, all appeals by the volunteer army were mostly ignored, yet whenever the Bolsheviks showed up and demanded money and valuables, the population obediently handed over millions of rubles and whole stores of goods. When former Russian prime minister of the provisional government, Prince G.E. Lvov, L.V.O.V., begging for aid abroad, visited New York and Washington in 1918, he met a delegation of American Jews who heard him out, but offered no aid. However, Pasmanek quotes a letter saying that by the end of 1918, quote, more than 3.5 million rubles were being collected in the exclusive Jewish circle with accompanying, quote, promises and reassurances of goodwill toward Jews from the white authorities. Despite that, Jews were officially prohibited to buy land in Chernomorskaya Gubernia because of, quote, vicious speculations by several Jews, quote, though the order was revoked soon afterwards. Here is another example from my own sources, says Solzhenitsyn. Again in Rostov, in February 1918, when the white movement was merely nascent and seemed almost hopeless, an elderly Jewish engineer and manufacturer, A.I. Arkhang Oradsky, who sincerely considered himself a Russian patriot, literally pushed his reluctant student son into joining the white youth, marching out into the night, embarking on their ice march, capital I.M., however, his sister didn't let him go. The Jewish Encyclopedia also tells us that, quote, the Jews of Rostov were joining Cossack guerrilla squadrons and the students' battalion of white General L. Kornilov's army. He's another big name in the whites. Maybe the biggest, K-O-R-N-I-L-O-V, Kornilov's army. So again, why this focus on the Jewish exceptions rather than emphasizing the Jewish rule? Again, all academic or just, they don't sum it up. Some of these people, and it's funny to say, but if they'd ever written for money, they would sum stuff up. They have so much space. They go on forever. And it tends to, if you're interested in every little detail of history, then I suppose it's valuable. But if you're trying to get the lessons, then you need the summary of this, the fair, true pattern. Pattern spotting is what you're looking for. And the pattern here is the Jews, no matter what they may proclaim in public, they side with the murderous Bolsheviks. They dominate them. They lead them. They're most of the commissars. They're a lot of the army, and they're a lot of the army generals, and they're a lot of the executive committee committees that are deciding what the army is going to do. In Paris in 1975, Colonel Levitin, the last surviving commander of the Kornilov Regiment, told me that quite a few Jewish warrant officers who were commissioned in Kerensky's times were loyal to Kornilov during the so-called, quote, days of Kornilov in August 1917. He recalled one Katzman, a holder of the Order of St. George from the 1st Kutepov Division. Yet we know that many whites rejected sympathetic or neutral Jews because of the prominent involvement of other Jews on the red side. Mistrust and anger was bred among the white forces. A modern study suggests that, quote, during the first year of its existence, the white movement was virtually free of anti-Semitism, at least in terms of major incidents, and Jews were actually serving in the Volunteer Army, capital VA. However, the situation dramatically changed by 1919. First, after the Allied victory in World War I, the widespread conviction among the whites that Germans helped Bolsheviks was displaced by a mythos about Jews being the backbone of Bolshevism. Again, the Germans allowing Lenin and his compatriots to pass through their territory on a train to help kick Russia out of the war. And the Russians are saying, well, the Germans are on the side of the Bolsheviks. But now they're saying that, well, the Jews are on the side of the Bolsheviks. On the other hand, after the white troops occupied Ukraine, they came under the influence of obsessive local anti-Semitism that facilitated their espousal of anti-Jewish actions. The White Army, quote, was hypnotized by Trotsky and Nakhamkis, an agent of the Bolshevik Central Committee, and that caused the identification of Bolshevism with Jewry and led to pogroms. The whites perceived Russia as occupied by Jewish commissars, and they marched to liberate her. Again, where's the lie, though, as the kids say? And given considerable unaccountability of separate units of that nascent and poorly organized army strewn over the vast Russian territories and the general lack of central authority in that war, it is not surprising that, unfortunately, some white troops carried out pogroms. Quote, A.I. Denikin, like some other leaders of the South Army, e.g. V.Z. May-Bayevsky, endorsed Kadet, the Constitutional Democratic Party, and socialist revolutionary views, and sought to stop these outrages perpetrated by his troops, yet those efforts were not effective. Naturally, many Jews were driven by survival instinct, and even if they initially expected goodwill on the part of the Volunteer Army, after pogroms by Denikin's troops, they lost any inclination to support the white movement. Pasmanek provides a lively case. Alexandrovsk was taken by the volunteers from the Bolsheviks. They were met by unanimous, sincere joy of the citizenry. Overnight, half of the town was sacked and filled by the screaming and moaning of distressed Jews. Wives were raped, men beaten and murdered. Jewish homes were totally ransacked. The pogrom continued for 3 days and three nights. Post-executive Cossack Cornet Sliva dismissed complaints of the public administration, saying, "It is always like that. We take a city and it belongs to the troops for 3 days." It is impossible to explain all this plunder and violence by soldiers of the Volunteer Army by actions of Jewish commissars. A top white general, Avon Lamp, claims that rumors about Jewish pogroms by the whites are, quote, tendentiously exaggerated, just like they had exaggerated the pogroms in Kishinev and Gomel and such earlier in the 20th century. Von Lamp said they are tendentiously exaggerated, the claims about Jewish pogroms, that these pillaging, quote, requisitions were unavoidable, actions of an army without quartermaster services, that is, supplies, the quartermaster, or regular supplies from the rear areas. They had to take from the population because they didn't have anything to eat or wear, or not enough. He says that the Jews were not targeted deliberately, but that all citizens suffered, and that Jews suffered more because they were numerous and rich. Direct quote. Quote, I am absolutely confident that in the operational theaters of the white armies, there were no Jewish pogroms, i.e. no organized extermination and pillaging of Jews. There were robberies and even murders, which were purposefully overblown and misrepresented as anti-Jewish pogroms by special press. Again, that would fit the earlier pattern of Kishinev, right? Where they blacken their name in the international press, making up lies. And again, he said that the White Army could hardly raise any funds. The Jews wouldn't support it, but they did support the Bolsheviks with millions. So they have to raise their money as they can in their desperate attempt to ward off the Red Terror. Because of these accidents, the 2nd Kuban Infantry Brigade and the Ossetian Cavalry Regiment were disbanded. All the people, be they Christian or Jewish, suffered in disorderly areas. There were exceptions on tip-offs by locals of these unfortunate commissars and Czechists who did not manage to escape, and there were quite a few Jews among them. Events in Fastov in September 1919 appeared differently. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, Cossacks, quote, behaved outrageously. They killed, raped, and flouted Jewish religious feelings. They had broken into a synagogue during Yom Kippur, beat up the whole congregation, raped the women, and tore apart the Torah scrolls, about 1,000 were killed. A methodical quarter-by-quarter pillaging of Jews in Kiev after a brief return of the white troops in the end of October 1919 was dubbed the, quote, quiet pogrom. Shulgin writes, the commander strictly prohibited pogroms, yet the, quote, Yids were really an annoyance, and secondly, the heroes were hungry. In general, the volunteers in large cities were starving. There were nights of plunder, but without murder and rape. It was, quote, the end of Denikin's period and the beginning of the agony of the volunteer army. Quote, by the rout of its offensive and particularly its retreat, during its last brutal retreat in November-December of 1919, the White Army carried out, quote, a large number of Jewish pogroms, unquote, acknowledged by Denikin, apparently not only for plunder but also for revenge. However, Beekerman says that, quote, murders, pillage, and rape of women were not faithful companions of the White Army, unlike what is claimed by our own Jewish National Socialists, who exaggerate the horrible events to advance their own agenda. So again, you're seeing people constantly saying that Jews are lying about stuff, and I believe them, because that is the pattern. Shulgin agrees, quote, for a true white, a massacre of unarmed civilians, the murder of women and children, and robbing of someone's property are absolutely impossible things to do. Well, that'd be the no true Scotsman fallacy. Thus, the, quote, true whites in this case are guilty of negligence. They were not sufficiently rigorous in checking the scum adhering to the white movement. Pasmanek concurred that, quote, everybody understands that General Denikin did not want pogroms, but when I was in Novorossiysk and Ekaterinodar in April-May 1919, i.e. before the march to the north, I could sense a thickened and pervasive atmosphere of anti-Semitism everywhere. Whatever it was, negligence or revenge, it served well to ignite the, quote, white pogroms of 1919. Still, quote, by unanimous testimony of those unlucky enough to experience both types of pogroms, those by Petliura's troops, that would be in Ukraine, we heard about last time in the first part of the chapter, and those by the White Army, it was predominantly Petliura's troops who went for Jewish life and soul. They did the most killing. It was not the volunteer army that initiated Jewish pogroms in the new Russia. They began in the, quote, reborn, unquote, Poland the day after she became a free and independent state. While in Russia itself, they were started by the Ukrainian troops of the Democrat Petliura, P-E-T-L-I-U-R-A, and the socialist Vinnychenko, V-Y-N-N-Y, Vinnychenko, C-H-E-N-K-O. Vinnychenko and Petliura were the main anti-Jews in Ukraine. The Ukrainians turned pogroms into an everyday event. The volunteer army did not start the pogroms, but it carried on with them, being fueled by a false conviction that all Jews were for the Bolsheviks. The name of L. Trotsky was particularly hated among the whites, and Petliura's soldiers in almost every pogrom went under a slogan, "This is what you get for Trotsky. This is what you get for Trotsky. This is what you're going to do it to Russia under Trotsky. This is what you get in return for that." And even the cadets who in their past always denounced any expression of anti-Semitism, and all the more so the pogroms, during their November 1919 conference in Kharkov, demanded that Jews declare relentless war against those elements of Jewry who actively participate in the Bolshevist movement. Direct quote. At the same time, the cadets, the K, quote, emphasized that the white authorities do everything possible to stop pogroms, namely that since the beginning of October 1919, the leadership of the volunteer army began punishing pogromists with many measures, including execution, and as a result, pogroms stopped for a while. Yet, quote, during the December 1919, March 1920 retreat of the volunteer army from Ukraine, the pogroms became particularly violent, and the Jews were accused of shooting the retreating whites in the back. Importantly, quote, there were no pogroms in Siberia by A. Kolchak's troops, as Kolchak did not tolerate pogroms. Diolinsky himself, a former white guard, emphatically writes, quote, Jewry was possibly given a unique chance to fight so hard for the Russian land that the slanderous claim that for Jews Russia is just geography and not fatherland would disappear for once and for all. Actually, quote, There was and is no alternative. The victory of anti-Bolshevik forces will lead from suffering to revival of the whole country and of the Jewish people in particular. Jewry should devote itself to the Russian cause entirely, to sacrifice their lives and wealth. Through the dark stains on the white chasubles, one should perceive the pure soul of the white movement. In an army where many Jewish youths were enlisted, in an army relying on extensive material support from the Jewish population, anti-Semitism would suffocate, and any pogromist movement would be countered and checked by internal forces. Jewry should have supported the Russian army, which went on in an immortal struggle for the Russian land. Jewry was pushed from the Russian cause, yet Jewry had to push away the pushers. He writes all this, quote, after having painful personal experience of participation in the white movement. Despite all those dark and serious problems that surfaced in the white movement, we delightfully and with great reverence bow our uncovered heads before this one and only commendable fact of the struggle against the ignominy of Russian history, the so-called Russian Revolution. It was a, quote, a great movement for the unfading values of upholding the human spirit. So kind of like a Southerner after, and the lost cause is the way he's looking at it, saying, hey, they should have supported Russia. If they're Russians and this isn't just some land that they might buy or make profit from, they should have been with us, and they weren't. That's D.O. Linsky, L-I-N-S-K-Y, a former white guard. Now, I don't know if he's a Jew or not. I'm thinking he's not. Yet the White Army did not support even those Jews who volunteered for service in it. Sounds to me like Jews are just suffering the benefits of their own behavior. They want to be a tribe when there's anything positive, but the minute there's anything negative, oh, you can't generalize about Jews negatively, only positively, just same as they do with blacks. You can't say anything negative in general about Jews. The minute there's something negative, well, you got to take them as individuals. They divide up, but then when it comes to something positive, why, they're all in it together. Or when they're persecuted, they're all persecuted together. And they're all good together whenever they're good. But like in the way that the cure of polio is attributed to a Jew. Why talk about, why isn't he just an individual who might have had a role in helping it? If that's even true. And it is debated, believe it or not. It is debated. But yet when they do negative things, well, you have to take them one by one all of a sudden. Yet the White Army did not support even those Jews who volunteered for service in it. What a humiliation people like Dr. Pasmanek had to go through. Many Jews were outraged after finding him among the pogromists. Quote, the volunteer army persistently refused to accept Jewish petty officers and cadets, even those who in 1917, October, bravely fought against Bolsheviks. It was a huge moral blow to Russian Jewry. Quote, I will never forget, he writes, how 11 Jewish petty officers came to me in Simferopol complaining that they were expelled from fighting units and posted as cooks in the rear. Well, the way your people act is the way they're taken. If the majority of Jews weren't disloyal, obnoxious, well, they're not disloyal. That's the conservative way of putting it. If the majority of them weren't anti-Russian, anti-white, then the ones who seem to be otherwise wouldn't be suspected. Why would a Jew complain about being treated as a Jew rather than a Russian? That's what he wanted. That's how his behavior shows he should be taken. When someone shows you what they are, believe them, as Oprah says, or else someone that Oprah would have on her show said, which I like. When someone shows you who he is, believe him. Shulgin writes, if only as many Jews participated in the white movement as did in the revolutionary democracy or in constitutional democracy before that, yet only a tiny part of Jewry joined the white guards. Only a very few individuals, whose dedication could not be overvalued as the anti-Semitism among the whites was already clearly obvious by that time. Meanwhile, there were many Jews among the Reds. There, most importantly, they often occupied the top command position, so they're most visible. Aren't we really aware of the bitter tragedy of those few Jews who joined the volunteer army? Again, this is conservatism. Focus on the outlier instead of the rule. And this is exactly it. And ultimately, even though this is more associated with Anglo, which means more Protestant Christian way of arguing. This ultimately comes from the Catholic view that if you can turn, if you can convert one Jew into a solid person, and they leave out the thousand years part to prove it, then that proves that the other 999 could do the same thing as well. It's argument by exception. The exception proves that the rule is invalid. And now here's a little bit of learning for you. Now, that expression apparently originally in German, because the verb in German, I think it's proben, but it's test, sounds very similar. It's a false cognate. It's a word that is sort of spelled like an English word, so you might think it means the same. And there was a mistranslation, but it doesn't. It means exactly the opposite. The exception tests the rule, apparently, is the saying in German. But in English, we converted that proben into proves the rule. The exception proves the rule, something dumb people like to say, because not necessarily that they're dumb, that they're unthinking. How can the exception prove the rule? It can't. It tests the rule. If you have enough exceptions, that's like saying if you have more exceptions, the more exceptions you have, the more proven the rule is. That's absurd in the face of it. The more exceptions you have, the more it calls the rule into question. All right? So the conservative weak way of arguing ultimately derives from Catholic argumentation. Remember, Catholicism was only Christianity for practical purposes. It existed for 1,500 years. It has more worked out arguments than this other stuff. Now, that's their bogus way of arguing. So why all this folk, and he who's making these weak conservative, you'd think he was an angler. You really would think his name was Simpson. Always a long beard and his name ends in S-K-Y, figuratively. Well, that doesn't mean he's any smarter than anyone named Simpson or Butler or Cutler or something, right? It doesn't. And so why focus on a tiny handful of individuals? I guess he's trying to prove how fair he is. Why are you unfair to the Russian people who are always summing it up accurately? Look, Jew equals Cheka equals red terror. Red terror equals Jew terror. White equals pro-Russian, red equals Jew. Yeah, there could be some exceptions, but how do you know they're not spies and invaders? That's just as likely. Only a tiny part of the Jewry joined the white guards. Only a very few individuals. He's admitting that. And God, he's going to talk at length about every single one. It's exactly like all the conservative parlor trick, as I've called it many times before. Defending white interests through Jews or through blacks. He's going to drag out the one black conservative he can find. Only a very few individuals. Meanwhile, there were many Jews among the Reds. There, most importantly, they often occupied the top command positions. Aren't we really aware of the bitter tragedy of those few Jews who joined the volunteer army? The lives of those Jewish volunteers were as endangered by the enemy's bullets as they were by the heroes of the rear who tried to solve the Jewish question in their own manner. Yet it was not all about the, quote, heroes of the rear, and anti-Semitic feelings had burst into flames among the young white officers from the intellectual families, despite all their education, tradition, and upbringing. No, not despite it, because of it. The Germans were the most highly educated people in the world, and for no reason they turned on Jews. Even the Malone, this honest, I suppose, Irish-descended doctor who was telling the truth about the mRNA that he invented, even he is going, oh, the Germans went barking mad, they went crazy. No, it's the opposite of the truth. They took the position on Jews they did because they were educated. No one else has ever made that point, but I've made it, and it's exactly right. So here is Solzhenitsyn falling into the same error. The people who see the Jews for what they are and stand up to them, those are the good people, the valuable people, the solids, we'll call them. And these are the ones who are the officers in the white army, of course, right? Leading the people of the volunteer army. So not despite, but because of. And this all the more doomed the white army to isolation and perdition. Oh, there you go. Now that's him saying it. That's not a quote. Most of his stuff is quoted. That's a open Jared Taylor position. Well, we can't win unless we have Jews on our side anyway. So we have to suck up to them, even though they're exactly the thing we're fighting. They were never going to get serious support from Jews anyway, and he's got to know that. Linsky tells us that on the territories controlled by the Volunteer Army, the Jews were not employable in the government services or the OSVAG, the Information Propaganda Agency, an intelligence and counterintelligence agency established in the White Army by General A.M. Dragomirov, yet he refutes the claim that publications of OSVAG contain anti-Semitic propaganda and that the pogromists were not punished. No, quote, the command did not want Jewish pogroms, yet it could not act against the pogromist attitude of the troops. It psychologically couldn't use severe measures. The army was not as it used to be, and requirements of the regular wartime or peacetime military charters could not be fully applied to it, unquote, as the minds of all soldiers were already battle-scarred by the Civil War. They're fighting. They're not going to, oh, you're going to stop us going after Jews when Jews are clearly behind the Red Terror? Fuck you. Although they didn't want pogroms, Denikin's government didn't dare to denounce anti-Semitic propaganda loudly, despite the fact that pogroms inflicted great harm on Denikin's army. That has to be proven. Pasmanek concludes, the Volunteer Army, quote, generally assumed a hostile attitude toward the entire Russian Jewry, but I. Levin disagrees, saying that, quote, the views of only one part of the movement, those of the active pogromists, are now attributed to the whole movement, while in reality, quote, the white movement was quite complex. It was composed of different factions with often opposite views. Now, whites are not a monolith, but Jews are. That's the difference. Yet to bet on Bolsheviks, to walk, some political differences can divide whites. They're not as racially loyal, but Jews are racially loyal. So they must be taken as a monolith. Yet to bet on Bolsheviks, to walk in the shadows, in their shadows because of fear of pogroms, is obvious and evident madness. A Jew says, either the Bolsheviks or the pogroms, whereas he should have been saying, the longer the Bolsheviks hold power, the closer we are to certain death. Why would they be saying that? They weren't killing off Jews, they were killing off Russians, whites. Yet the Judeo-communists were, in the parlance of the whites, agitators as well. So the Jews and the Russians are both seeing it the same way, and Solzhenitsyn is trying to make these clever distinctions that ultimately don't really matter. All this was resolutely stopped by Wrangel in Crimea, where there was nothing like what was described above. Wrangel even personally ordered Reverend Vladimir Vostokov to stop his public anti-Jewish sermons. How'd that work out for him? In July 1920, Shulam Bezpilov, the aforementioned Jewish millionaire, wrote from Paris to Wrangel in the Crimea, quote, we must save our motherland. She will be saved by the children of the soil and industrialists. We must give away 75% of our revenue until the value of ruble has recovered and normal life rebuilt. July 1920, Shulam Bezpilov. Yet it was already too late. Still, a part of the Jewish population of the Crimea chose to evacuate with Wrangel's army. True, the white movement was in desperate need of the support by the Western public opinion, which in turn largely depended on the fate of Russian Jewry. See, again, even 100-plus years ago, all they care about in England, America, etc., all they care about is Jews. They don't give a damn about Russians or what the Jews are doing to the Russians, only about what the Russians are doing to and for the Jews. Complete control of the media in all countries, even at that point in 1920. It needed that support from the West, yet, as we saw, it had fatally and unavoidably developed a hostility toward the Jews, and later it was not able to prevent pogroms. As Secretary of State for War, Winston Churchill, quote, was the major advocate of the Allied intervention in Russia and military aid to the White Armies. Because of the pogroms, Churchill appealed directly to Denikin, quote, my goal of securing the support in Parliament for the Russian National Movement will be incomparably more difficult if the pogroms are not stopped. And notice how his Parliament doesn't give a damn about the miseries and the murder the Red Terror under the Jews has inflicted on the Russians. All they care about is Jews. So before he sold out, Churchill was actually doing something good before he flipped, and he came to recognize, probably partly because of this, that the Jewish power was just too great to be resisted. Better to join them and take their money. And Churchill is the number one hero of the conservatives, who are cucks, right? Sellouts, cucks. Career girls, as I like to call them. Churchill also feared the reaction of powerful Jewish circles among the British elite. Jewish circles in the USA held similar opinions on the situation in Russia. However, the pogroms were not stopped, which largely explains the extremely weak and reluctant assistance given by the Western powers to the White Armies. That's complete bullshit. They didn't give the money because they were controlled by Jews, and the Jews want the Bolsheviks to win. And calculations by Wall Street naturally led it to support Bolsheviks as the more likely future rulers over Russia's riches. Moreover, the climate in the U.S. and Europe was permeated by sympathy toward those who claimed to be builders of a new world with their grandiose plans and great social objective. So we move on to 517. And yet, the behavior of the former Entente of Western nations during the entire Civil War is striking by its greed and blind indifference toward the white movement, the successor of their wartime ally, Imperial Russia. They even demanded that the whites join the Bolshevik delegation at the Versailles Peace Conference. Then there was that delirious idea of peace negotiations with the Bolsheviks on the Prince's Islands. The Entente, which did not recognize any of the white governments officially, was hastily recognizing all those new national states emerging on the periphery of Russia, thus unambiguously betraying the desire for its dismemberment. The British hurried to occupy the oil-rich region of Baku. The Japanese claimed parts of the Far East and the Kamchatka Peninsula. The American troops in Siberia were more of a hindrance than a help and actually facilitated the capture of Primorye by the Bolsheviks. The Allies even extorted payments for any aid they provided, in gold from Kolchak, in the south of Russia in the form of Black Sea vessels, concessions, and future obligations. There were truly shameful episodes when the British were leaving the Archangel region in the Russian north. They took with them some of the Tsar's military equipment and ammunition. They gave some of what they couldn't take to the Reds and sunk the rest in the sea to prevent it from getting into the hands of the whites. And there you go, your traitorous, treacherous Anglo. In the spring of 1920, the Entente put forward an ultimatum to the white generals Denikin and Wrangel, demanding an end to their struggle against the Bolsheviks. In the summer of 1920, France provided some material aid to Wrangel so that he could help Poland. Yet only 6 months later, they were parsimoniously deducting Wrangel's military equipment as payment for feeding those Russian soldiers who retreated to Gallipoli. We can judge about the actions of the few occupational forces actually sent by the Entente from a testimonial by Prince Grigory Trubetskoy, a serious diplomat, Trubetskoy, Trubetskoy, who observed the French army during its occupation of Odessa in 1919. Quote, "French policies in the south of Russia in general and their treatment of the issues of Russian statehood in particular were strikingly confused, revealing their gross misunderstanding of the situation." New section here in the bottom of 517. The black streak of Jewish pogroms in Ukraine ran through the whole of 1919 and the beginning of 1920. By their scope, scale, and atrocity, these pogroms immeasurably exceeded all the previous historical instances discussed in this book, the pogroms of 1881-82, after the assassination, 1903 and 1905. Yehuda Larin, a high-placed Soviet functionary, wrote in the 1920s that during the Civil War, Ukraine saw a, quote, "very large number of massive Jewish pogroms, far exceeding anything from the past with respect to the number of victims and the number of perpetrators." Vinichenko allegedly said that the, quote, "the pogroms would stop only when the Jews would stop being communists." There is no precise estimate of the number of victims of these pogroms. Of course, no reliable count could be performed in that situation, neither during the events nor immediately afterwards. In the book Jewish Pogroms, we read, quote, "the number of murdered in Ukraine and Byelorussia between 1917 and 1921 is approximately 180,000 to 200,000. The number of orphans alone, 300,000, bespeaks of the enormous scale of the catastrophe." The present-day Jewish Encyclopedia tells us that, quote, "by different estimates, from 70,000 to 180,000 to 200,000 Jews were killed." Compiling data from different Jewish sources, a modern historian comes up with 900 mass pogroms, mass in italics, of which 40% by Petliura's Ukrainian directorate troops, 25% by the squads of the various Ukrainian Atamans, A-T-A-M-A-N-S, I guess that's their name for some kind of military chieftain, 17% by Denikin's White Army troops, and 8.5% by the 1st Cavalry Army of Budyani and other Red Army troops. Yet how many butchered lives are behind these figures? Already during the Civil War, National and Socialist Jewish parties began merging with the Reds. The Vereinigkeiten, the United Jewish Socialist Workers' Party, turned into the Kommunvereinigkeiten, Communist Jewish Socialist Workers' Party, and, quote, adopted the communist program, and together with the communist wing of the Bund, formed the All-Russian Kommbund in June 1920. In Ukraine, associates and members of the Vereinigkeiten, together with the Ukrainian Kommbund, formed the Komfarband, the Jewish Communist Union, which later joined the All-Russian Communist Party of Bolsheviks. In 1919 in Kiev, the official Soviet press provided text in three languages, Russian, Ukrainian, and Yiddish. 1919 official Soviet press in Kiev, Russian, Ukrainian, and Yiddish. Quote, the Bolsheviks used these pogroms in Ukraine to their enormous advantage. They extremely skillfully exploited the pogroms in order to influence public opinion in Russia and abroad, in many Jewish and non-Jewish circles in Europe and America. Yet the Reds had the finger in the pie as well. They were actually the first ones. Quote, in the spring of 1918, units of the Red Army, retreating from Ukraine, perpetrated pogroms using the slogan, quote, strike the Yids and the bourgeoisie. Quote, the most atrocious pogroms were carried out by the 1st Cavalry Army during its retreat from Poland in the end of August 1920. Yet historical awareness of the pogroms carried out by the Red Army during the Civil War has been rather glossed over. Only a few condemning voices have spoken on the topic. Pasmanik wrote, quote, during the first winter of Bolshevik rule, the Red troops fighting under the Red Banner carried out several bloody pogroms, most notable of which were pogroms in Glukov and Novgorod-Siversky. Why is there a special word for attacking Jews? Or a special word for hating Jews? Jews aren't special. By number of victims, deliberate brutality, torture, and abuse, those two had eclipsed even the Kalush massacre. Retreating before the advancing Germans, the Red troops were destroying Jewish settlements on the route. S. Maslov is also quite clear. Quote, the march of Budyani's cavalry army during its relocation from the Polish to the Crimean front was marked by thousands of murdered Jews, thousands of raped women, and dozens of utterly razed and looted Jewish settlements. In Zhytomyr, each new authority inaugurated its rule with a pogrom, and often repeatedly after each time the city changed hands again. The feature of all those pogroms, says Maslov, by Petliura's troops, the Poles, or the Soviets, was the large number of killed. The Bogunsky and Tarashansky regiments stood out in particular, Bogunsky, Tarashansky, though those two having come over to Budyani from the directorate. Allegedly, those regiments were disarmed because of the pogroms, and the instigators were hanged. The above-cited socialist S. Schwartz concludes from his historical standpoint, 1952, quote, during the revolutionary period, particularly during the Civil War, anti-Semitism has grown extraordinarily, and especially in the South, spread extensively in the broad masses of the urban and rural population. Alas, the resistance of the Russian population to the Bolsheviks, without which we wouldn't have a right to call ourselves a people, had faltered and took wrong turns in many ways, including on the Jewish issue. Meanwhile, the Bolshevik regime was touting the Jews and they were joining it, and the Civil War was more and more broadening that chasm between Reds and Whites. Quote, if the revolution in general has cleared Jewry of suspicion in counter-revolutionary attitude, the counter-revolution has suspected all Jewry of being pro-revolutionary. And thus, quote, the Civil War became an unbearable torment for Jewry, further consolidating them in the wrong revolutionary positions, and so, quote, they failed to recognize the genuine redemptive essence of the White armies. Again, it's just making excuses for them. Let's not overlook the general situation during the Civil War. Quote, it was literally a chaos which released an unbridled anarchy across Russia. Anybody who wanted and was able to rob and kill was robbing and killing whoever he wanted. Officers of the Russian army were massacred in the hundreds and thousands by bands of mutinous rabble. Entire families of landowners were murdered. Estates were burned. Valuable pieces of art were pilfered and destroyed. In some places and manners, all living things, including livestock, were exterminated. Mob rule spread terror on the streets of cities. Owners of plants and factories were driven out of their enterprises and dwellings. Tens of thousands of people all over Russia were shot for the glory of the proletarian revolution. Others rotted in stinking and vermin-infested prisons as hostages. It was not a crime or personal actions that put a man under the axe, but his affiliation with a certain social stratum or class. Again, that's exactly what I was saying in the last recording. It's ideology, right? They're not judging as individuals. They're judging as an ideology. What class do you belong to? What ultimately, it's not even class. It's just what category do you belong to? They can frame it in terms of economics. Then they would use class. But today they frame it in terms of race, and they'd be anti-white. If you're white, you're bad. If you're black, you're good. If you're Jew, you're good. If you're queer, you're good. If you're normal, you're not good. But the key is just category. There's good categories and bad categories, and if they're bad, you can kill them. It has nothing to do with individual action as we're used to thinking of it. It would be an absolute miracle if, under conditions when whole human groups were designated for extermination, the group named Jews remained exempt. The curse of the time was that it was possible to declare an entire class or tribe evil. Well, this thinking came from the Jews directly. So condemning an entire social class to destruction is called revolution, yet to kill and rob Jews is called a pogrom? The Jewish pogrom in the south of Russia was a component of the all-Russian pogrom. And he was quoting somebody. Oh, it actually ends here in 519, so we got one more paragraph only. Such was the woeful acquisition of all the peoples of Russia, including the Jews, after the successful attainment of equal rights, after the splendid revolution of March 1917, that both the general sympathy of the Russian Jews toward the Bolsheviks and the developed attitude of the white forces toward Jews eclipsed and erased the most important benefit of a possible white victory. The sane evolution of the Russian state. And that ends the Civil War and the Jews, his chapter on that, chapter 16. And let's see. I think I'm trying to figure this was recording number 25, ending chapter 16 of 200 Years Together, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, permanently archived at vnnforum.com. I don't think there's too much more to say. I think he's bending over backwards. I'll just repeat what I said. He's bending over backwards to be fair to Jews, and he's bending over forwards to be as anti-Russian as he can, and, you know, within rational perimeters. He wants to blame the Jews, but just a little, and not wholly, and he's trying to point out all the good ones. And it's not the way I think you would rationally go about it. I think you should be reinforcing, saying they had every reason to see the Jews as revolutionaries. Even when they got what they wanted, they were unhappy. Even when they got everything they wanted before the revolution, they still revolted. And then when they got power, they killed tens of millions of our people. So what's the word for the attack of the Jews on the Russians, or the attack of the Jews and the whites? There is no special word, but yet there's a special word for anyone who dares raise a hand in self-defense against Jews. It's called pogrom. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from Solzhenitsyn real soon.